appear so many faint and unsuccessful copies of the original. Of the swarms that so closely trod in the footsteps of the first pilgrims, the chiefs were equal in rank, though unequal in fame and merit, to Godfrey of Bouillon and his fellow adventurers. At their head were displayed the banners of the Dukes of Burgundy, Bavaria, and Aquitaine, the first a descendant of Hugh Capet, the second a father of the Brunswick line, the Archbishop of Milan, a temporal prince, transported for the benefit of the Turks the treasures and ornaments of his church and palace, and the veteran crusaders, Hugh the Great and Stephen of Chartres, returned to consummate their unfinished vow. The huge and disorderly bodies of their followers moved forward in two columns, and if the first consisted of 260,000 persons, the second might possibly amount to 60,000 horse and 100,000 foot. The armies of the Second Crusade might have claimed the conquest of Asia. The nobles of France and Germany were animated by the presence of their sovereigns, and both the rank and personal character of Conrad and Louis gave a dignity to their cause and a discipline to their force which might be vainly expected from the feudatory chiefs. The cavalry of the emperor and that of the king was each composed of 70,000 knights and their immediate attendants in the field. And if the light-armed troops, the peasant infantry, the women and children, the priests and monks be rigorously excluded, the full account will scarcely be satisfied with 400,000 souls. The West, from Rome to Britain, was called into action. The kings of Poland and Bohemia obeyed the summons of Conrad, and it is affirmed by the Greeks and Latins that in the passage of a strait or river, the Byzantine agents, after a tale of 900,000, desisted from the endless and formidable computation. In the Third Crusade, as the French and English preferred the navigation of the Mediterranean, the host of Frederick Barbarossa was less numerous. 15,000 knights and as many squires were the flower of the German chivalry. 60,000 horse and 100,000 foot were mustered by the emperor in the plains of Hungary, and after such repetitions we shall no longer be startled at the 600,000 pilgrims which credulity has ascribed to this last immigration. Such extravagant reckonings prove only the astonishment of contemporaries, but their astonishment most strongly bears testimony to the existence of an enormous, though indefinite, multitude. The Greeks might applaud their superior knowledge of the arts and stratagems of war, but they confessed the strength and courage of the French cavalry and the infantry of the Germans, and the strangers are described as an iron race of gigantic stature who darted fire from their eyes and spilt blood like water on the ground. Under the banners of Conrad, a troop of females rode in the attitude and armor of men, and the chief of these Amazons, from her gilt spurs and buskins, obtained the epithet of the Golden-Footed Dame. The number and character of the strangers was an object of terror to the effeminate Greeks, and the sentiment of fear is nearly allied to that of hatred. This aversion was suspended or softened by the apprehension of the Turkish power, and the invectives of the Latins will not bias our more candid belief that the Emperor Alexius dissembled their insolence, eluded their hostilities, counseled their rashness, and opened to their ardor the road of pilgrimage and conquest. But when the Turks had been driven from Nice and the seacoast, when the Byzantine princes no longer dreaded the distant sultans of Cogni, they felt with purer indignation the free and frequent passage of the western barbarians who violated the majesty and endangered the safety of the empire. The Second and Third Crusades were undertaken under the reign of Manuel Comnenus and Isaac Angelus. Of the former, the passions were always impetuous and often malevolent, and the natural unity of a cowardly and a mischievous temper was exemplified in the latter, who, without merit or mercy, could punish a tyrant and occupy his throne. It was secretly and perhaps tacitly resolved by the prince and people to destroy, or at least to discourage the pilgrims by every species of injury and oppression, and their want of prudence and discipline continually afforded the pretense or the opportunity. The Western monarchs had stipulated a safe passage and fair market in the country of their Christian brethren. The treaty had been ratified by oaths and hostages, and the poorest soldier of Frederick's army was furnished with 3 marks of silver to defray his expenses on the road. But every engagement was violated by treachery and injustice, and the complaints of the Latins are attested by the honest confession of a Greek historian who has dared to prefer truth to his country. Instead of a hospitable reception, the gates of the cities, both in Europe and Asia, were closely barred against the crusaders, and the scanty pittance of food was let down in baskets from the walls. Experience or foresight might excuse this timid jealousy, but the common duties of humanity prohibited the mixture of chalk or other poisonous ingredients in the bread. And should Manuel be acquitted of any foul connivance, he is guilty of coining base money for the purpose of trading with the pilgrims. In every step of their march, they were stopped or misled. The governors had private orders to fortify the passes and break down the bridges against them. The stragglers were pillaged and murdered. The soldiers and horses were pierced in the woods by arrows from an invisible hand. The sick were burnt in their beds, and the dead bodies were hung on gibbets along the highways. These injuries exasperated the champions of the cross, who were not endowed with evangelical patience, and the Byzantine princes, who had provoked the unequal conflict, promoted the embarkation and march of these formidable guests. On the verge of the Turkish frontier, Barbarossa spared the guilty Philadelphia, rewarded the hospitable Laodicea, and deplored the hard necessity that had stained his sword with any drops of Christian blood. In their intercourse with the monarchs of Germany and France, the pride of the Greeks was exposed to an anxious trial. They might boast that on the first interview the seat of Louis was a low stool beside the throne of Manuel. But no sooner had the French king transported his army beyond the Bosphorus than he refused the offer of a second conference, unless his brother would meet him on equal terms, either on the sea or land. With Conrad and Frederick, the ceremonial was still nicer and more difficult. Like the successors of Constantine, they styled themselves emperors of the Romans, and firmly maintained the purity of their title and dignity. The first of these representatives of Charlemagne would only converse with Manuel on horseback in the open field. The second, by passing the Hellespont rather than the Bosphorus, declined the view of Constantinople and its sovereign. An emperor who had been crowned at Rome was reduced to the Greek epistles to the humble appellation of Rex, or Prince of the Alemanni, and the vain and feeble Angelus affected to be ignorant of the name of one of the greatest men and monarchs of the age. While they viewed with hatred and suspicion the Latin pilgrims, the Greek emperors maintained a strict though secret alliance with the Turks and Saracens. Isaac Angelus complained that by his friendship for the great Saladin, he had incurred the enmity of the Franks, and a mosque was founded at Constantinople for the public exercise of the religion of Muhammad. The swarms that followed the First Crusade were destroyed in Anatolia by famine, pestilence, and the Turkish arrows, and the princes only escaped with some squadrons of horse to accomplish their lamentable pilgrimage. A just opinion may be formed of their knowledge and humanity, of their knowledge from the design of subduing Persia and Khorasan in their way to Jerusalem, of their humanity from the massacre of the Christian people, a friendly city, who came out to meet them with palms and crosses in their hands. The arms of Conrad and Louis were less cruel and imprudent, but the event of the Second Crusade was still more ruinous to Christendom, and the Greek Manuel is accused by his own subjects of giving seasonable intelligence to the Sultan and treacherous guides to the Latin princes. Instead of crushing the common foe by double attack at the same time but on different sides, the Germans were urged by emulation, and the French were retarded by jealousy. Louis had scarcely passed the Bosphorus when he was met by the returning emperor, who had lost the greater part of his army in glorious but unsuccessful actions on the banks of the Meander. The contrast of the pomp of his rival hastened the retreat of Conrad. The desertion of his independent vassals reduced him to his hereditary troops, and he borrowed some Greek vessels to execute by sea the pilgrimage of Palestine. Without studying the lessons of experience or the nature of the war, the King of France advanced through the same country to a similar fate. The vanguard, which bore the royal banner and the Oriflamme of Saint-Denis, had doubled their march with rash and inconsiderate speed, and the rear, which the king commanded in person, no longer found their companions in the evening camp. In darkness and disorder they were encompassed, assaulted, and overwhelmed by the innumerable host of Turks who, in the art of war, were superior to the Christians of the 12th century. Louis, who climbed a tree in the general discomfiture, was saved by his own valor and the ignorance of his adversaries. And with the dawn of day he escaped alive, but almost alone, to the camp of the vanguard. But instead of pursuing his expedition by land, he was rejoiced to shelter the relics of his army in the friendly seaport of Satalia. From thence he embarked for Antioch, but so penurious was the supply of Greek vessels that they could only afford room for his knights and nobles, and the plebeian crowd of infantry was left to perish at the foot of the Pamphylian hills. The emperor and the king embraced and wept at Jerusalem. Their martial trains, the remnant of mighty armies, were joined to the Christian powers of Syria, and a fruitless siege of Damascus was the final effort of the Second Crusade. Conrad and Louis embarked for Europe with the personal fame of piety and courage. But the Orientals had braved these potent monarchs of the Franks, with whose names and military forces they had been so often threatened. Perhaps they had still more to fear from the veteran genius of Frederick I, who in his youth had served in Asia under his uncle Conrad. 40 campaigns in Germany and Italy had taught Barbarossa to command, and his soldiers, even the princes of the empire, were accustomed under his reign to obey. As soon as he lost sight of Philadelphia and Laodicea, the last cities of the Greek frontier, he plunged into the salt and barren desert, a land, says the historian, of horror and tribulation. During 20 days, every step of his fainting and sickly march was besieged by the innumerable hordes of Turkmens, whose numbers and fury seemed, after each defeat, to multiply and inflame. The emperor continued to struggle and to suffer, and such was the measure of his calamities that when he reached the gates of Iconium, no more than 1,000 knights were able to serve on horseback. By a sudden and resolute assault he defeated the guards and stormed the capital of the sultan, who humbly sued for pardon and peace. The road was now open, and Frederick advanced in a career of triumph till he was unfortunately drowned in a petty torrent of Cilicia. The remainder of his Germans was consumed by sickness and desertion, and the emperor's son expired with the greatest part of his Swabian vassals at the siege of Acre. Among the Latin heroes, Godfrey of Bouillon and Frederick Barbarossa could alone achieve the passage of the Lesser Asia. Yet even their success was a warning, and in the last and most experienced age of the Crusades, every nation preferred the sea to the toils and perils of an inland expedition. The enthusiasm of the First Crusade is a natural and simple event, while hope was fresh, danger untried, and enterprise congenial to the spirit of the times. But the obstinate perseverance of Europe may indeed excite our pity and admiration. That no instruction should have been drawn from constant and adverse experience, that the same confidence should have repeatedly grown from the same failures, that six succeeding generations should have rushed headlong down the precipice that was opened before them, and that men of every condition should have staked their public and private fortunes on the desperate adventure of possessing or recovering a tombstone 2,000 miles from their country. In a period of 2 centuries after the Council of Clermont, each spring and summer produced a new immigration of pilgrim warriors for the defense of the Holy Land. But the 7 great armaments or crusades were excited by some impending or recent calamity. The nations were moved by the authority of their pontiffs and the example of their kings. Their zeal was kindled, and their reason was silenced by the voice of their holy orators. And among these, Bernard, the monk, or the saint, may claim the most honorable place. About 8 years before the first conquest of Jerusalem, he was born of a noble family in Burgundy. At the age of 23, he buried himself in the monastery of Citeaux, then in the primitive fervor of the institution. At the end of 2 years, he led forth a 3rd colony, or daughter, to the valley of Clairvaux, in Champagne, and was content till the hour of his death with the humble station of abbot of his own community. A philosophic age has abolished, with too liberal and indiscriminate disdain, the honors of these spiritual heroes. The meanest among them are distinguished by some energies of the mind. They were at least superior to their votaries and disciples, and in the race of superstition they attained the prize for which such numbers contended. In speech, in writing, in action, Bernard stood high above his rivals and contemporaries. His compositions are not devoid of wit and eloquence, and he seems to have preserved as much reason and humanity as may be reconciled with the character of a saint. In a secular life he would have shared the 7th part of a private inheritance. By a vow of poverty and penance, by closing his eyes against the visible world, by the refusal of all ecclesiastical dignities, the abbot of Clairvaux became the oracle of Europe and the founder of 160 convents. Princes and pontiffs trembled at the freedom of his apostolical censures. France, England, and Milan consulted and obeyed his judgment in a schism of the Church. The debt was repaid by the gratitude of Innocent II, and his successor, Eugenius III, was the friend and disciple of the Holy Bernard. It was in the proclamation of the Second Crusade that he shone as the missionary and prophet of God, who called the nations to the defense of his holy sepulchre. At the Parliament of Vézelay he spoke before the king, and Louis VII, with his nobles, received their crosses from his hand. The abbot of Clairvaux then marched to the less easy conquest of the Emperor Conrad. A phlegmatic people, ignorant of his language, was transported by the pathetic vehemence of his tone and gestures, and his progress from Constance to Cologne was the triumph of eloquence and zeal. Bernard applauds his own success in the depopulation of Europe, affirms that cities and castles were emptied of their inhabitants, and computes that only one man was left behind for the consolation of 7 widows. The blind fanatics were desirous of electing him for their general, but the example of the hermit Peter was before his eyes, and while he assured the crusaders of the divine favor, he prudently declined a military command in which failure and victory would have been almost equally disgraceful to his character. Yet after the calamitous event, the abbot of Clairvaux was loudly accused as a false prophet, the author of the public and private mourning. His enemies exulted, his friends blushed, and his apology was slow and unsatisfactory. He justifies his obedience to the commands of the Pope, expiates on the mysterious ways of Providence, imputes the misfortunes of the pilgrims to their own sins, and modestly insinuates that his mission had been approved by signs and wonders. Had the fact been certain, the argument would be decisive, and his faithful disciples, who enumerate 20 or 30 miracles in a day, appeal to the public assemblies of France and Germany in which they were performed. At the present hour, such prodigies will not obtain credit beyond the precincts of Clairvaux. But in the preternatural cures of the blind, the lame, and the sick, who were presented to the man of God, it is impossible for us to ascertain the separate shares of accident, of fancy, of imposture, and of fiction. Omnipotence itself cannot escape the murmurs of its discordant votaries. Since the same dispensation which was applauded as a deliverance in Europe was deplored and perhaps arraigned as a calamity in Asia. After the loss of Jerusalem, the Syrian fugitives diffused their consternation and sorrow. Baghdad mourned in the dust. The Qadi Zinedine of Damascus tore his beard in the caliph's presence, and the whole divan shed tears at his melancholy tale. But the commanders of the faithful could only weep. They were themselves captives in the hands of the Turks. Some temporal power was restored to the last age of the Abbasides, but their humble ambition was confined to Baghdad and the adjacent province. Their tyrants, the Seljuk sultans, had followed the common law of the Asiatic dynasties, the unceasing round of valor, greatness, discord, degeneracy, and decay. Their spirit and power were unequal to the defense of religion, and in his distant realm of Persia, the Christians were strangers to the name and the arms of Sangiar, the last hero of his race. While the sultans were involved in the silken web of the harem, the pious task was undertaken by their slaves, the Atabeks, a Turkish name which, like the Byzantine patricians, may be translated by Father of the Prince. Askan Sar, a valiant Turk, had been the favorite of Malek Shah, from whom he received the privilege of standing on the right hand of the throne. But in the civil wars that ensued on the monarch's death, he lost his head and the government of Aleppo. His domestic emirs persevered in their attachment to his son Zengi, who proved his first arms against the Franks in the defeat of Antioch. 30 campaigns in the service of the caliph and sultan established his military fame, and he was invested with the command of Mosul as the only champion that could avenge the cause of the prophet. The public hope was not disappointed. After a siege of 21 days, he stormed the city of Edessa and recovered from the Franks their conquests beyond the Euphrates. The martial tribes of Kurdistan were subdued by the independent sovereign of Mosul and Aleppo. His soldiers were taught to behold the camp as their only country. They trusted to his liberality for their rewards, and their absent families were protected by the vigilance of Zengi. At the head of these veterans, his son Nur ed-Din gradually united the Mohammedan powers, added the kingdom of Damascus to that of Aleppo, and waged a long and successful war against the Christians of Syria. He spread his ample reign from the Tigris to the Nile, and the Abbasides rewarded their faithful servant with all the titles and prerogatives of royalty. The Latins themselves were compelled to own the wisdom and courage and even the justice and piety of this implacable adversary. In his life and government, the holy warrior revived the zeal and simplicity of the first caliphs. Gold and silk were banished from his palace, the use of wine from his dominions. The public revenue was scrupulously applied to the public service, and the frugal household of Nur ed-Din was maintained from his legitimate share of the spoil which he vested in the purchase of a private estate. His favorite sultana sighed for some female object of expense. "Alas," replied the king, "I fear God, and am no more than the treasurer of the Muslims. Their property I cannot alienate, but I still possess 3 shops in the city of Hems. These you may take, and these alone can I bestow." His chamber of justice was the terror of the great and the refuge of the poor. Some years after the sultan's death, an oppressed subject called aloud in the streets of Damascus, "O Nur ed-Din, Nur ed-Din, where art thou now? Arise, arise, to pity and protect us." A tumult was apprehended, and a living tyrant blushed or trembled at the name of a departed monarch. By the arms of the Turks and Franks, the Fatimites had been deprived of Syria. In Egypt, the decay of their character and influence was still more essential. Yet they were still revered as the descendants and successors of the Prophet. They maintained their invisible state in the palace of Cairo, and their person was seldom violated by the profane eyes of subjects or strangers. The Latin ambassadors have described their own introduction through a series of gloomy passages and glittering porticos. The scene was enlivened by the warbling of birds and the murmur of fountains. It was enriched by a display of rich furniture and rare animals. Of the imperial treasures, something was shown and much was supposed. And the long order of unfolding doors was guarded by black soldiers and domestic eunuchs. The sanctuary of the presence chamber was veiled with a curtain, and the vizier who conducted the ambassadors laid aside the scimitar and prostrated himself three times on the ground. The veil was then removed, and they beheld the commander of the faithful, who signified his pleasure to the first slave of the throne. But this slave was his master. The viziers or sultans had usurped the supreme administration of Egypt. The claims of the rival candidates were decided by arms, and the name of the most worthy, of the strongest, was inserted in the royal patent of command. The factions of Dagam and Shoa alternately expelled each other from the capital and country, and the weaker side implored the dangerous protection of the Sultan of Damascus or the King of Jerusalem, the perpetual enemies of the sect and monarchy of the Fatimites. By his arms and religion, the Turk was most formidable. But the Frank, in an easy, direct march, could advance from Gaza to the Nile, while the intermediate situation of his realm compelled the troops of Nur ed-Din to wheel round the skirts of Arabia, a long and painful circuit which exposed them to thirst, fatigue, and the burning winds of the desert. The secret zeal and ambition of the Turkish prince aspired to reign in Egypt under the name of the Abbasides. But the restoration of the suppliant Shoa was the ostensible motive of the first expedition, and the success was entrusted to the emir Shirakou, a valiant and veteran commander. Dagam was oppressed and slain, but the ingratitude, the jealousy, the just apprehensions of his more fortunate rival soon provoked him to invite the King of Jerusalem to deliver Egypt from his insolent benefactors. To this union the forces of Shirakou were unequal. He relinquished the premature conquest, and the evacuation of Belbeis, or Pelusium, was the condition of his safe retreat. As the Turks defiled before the enemy and their general closed the rear, with a vigilant eye and a battle-axe in his hand, a Frank presumed to ask him if he were not afraid of an attack. "It is doubtless in your power to begin the attack," replied the intrepid emir. "But rest assured that not one of my soldiers will go to paradise till he has sent an infidel to hell." His report of the riches of the land, the effeminacy of the natives, and the disorders of the government revived the hopes of Nur ed-Din. The caliph of Baghdad applauded the pious design, and Shirakou descended into Egypt a second time with 12,000 Turks and 11,000 Arabs. Yet his forces were still inferior to the confederate armies of the Franks and Saracens, and I can discern an unusual degree of military art in his passage of the Nile, his retreat from Thebais, his masterly evolutions in the Battle of Babain, the surprise of Alexandria, and his marches and countermarches in the flats and valley of Egypt, from the tropic to the sea. His conduct was seconded by the courage of his troops, and on the eve of action a Mameluke exclaimed, "If we cannot wrest Egypt from the Christian dogs, why do we not renounce the honors and rewards of the Sultan and retire to labor with the peasants or to spin with the females of the harem?" Yet after all his efforts in the field, after the obstinate defence of Alexandria by his nephew Saladin, an honourable capitulation and retreat concluded the second enterprise of Shirakuch, and Nur ad-Din reserved his abilities for a third and more propitious occasion. It was soon offered by the ambition and avarice of Amalric, or Amauri, king of Jerusalem, who had imbibed the pernicious maxim that no faith should be kept with the enemies of God. A religious warrior, the great master of the hospital, encouraged him to proceed. The emperor of Constantinople either gave or promised a fleet to act with the armies of Syria, and the perfidious Christian, unsatisfied with spoil and subsidy, aspired to the conquest of Egypt. In this emergency, the Muslims turned their eyes towards the Sultan of Damascus. The vizier, whom danger encompassed on all sides, yielded to their unanimous wishes, and Nur ad-Din seemed to be tempted by the fair offer of one-third of the revenue of the kingdom. The Franks were already at the gates of Cairo, but the suburbs, the old city, were burnt on their approach. They were deceived by an insidious negotiation, and their vessels were unable to surmount the barriers of the Nile. They prudently declined a contest with the Turks in the midst of a hostile country, and Amauri retired into Palestine with the shame and reproach that always adhere to unsuccessful injustice. After this deliverance, Shirakuch was invested with a robe of honour, which he soon stained with the blood of the unfortunate Shawar. For a while, the Turkish emirs condescended to hold the office of vizier, but this foreign conquest precipitated the fall of the Fatimites themselves, and the bloodless change was accomplished by a message and a word. The caliphs had been degraded by their own weakness and the tyranny of the viziers. Their subjects blushed when the descendant and successor of the prophet presented his naked hand to the rude grip of a Latin ambassador. They wept when he sent the hair of his women, a sad emblem of their grief and terror, to excite the pity of the Sultan of Damascus. By the command of Nur ad-Din and the sentence of the doctors, the holy names of Abu Bakr, Omar, and Othman were solemnly restored. The Caliph Mustadi of Baghdad was acknowledged in the public prayers as the true commander of the faithful, and the green livery of the sons of Ali was exchanged for the black color of the Abbasides. The last of his race, the Caliph Adid, who survived only 10 days, expired in happy ignorance of his fate. His treasures secured the loyalty of the soldiers and silenced the murmurs of the sectaries. And in all subsequent revolutions, Egypt has never departed from the orthodox tradition of the Muslims. The hilly country beyond the Tigris is occupied by the pastoral tribes of the Kurds, a people hardy, strong, savage, impatient of the yoke, addicted to rapine, and tenacious of the government of their national chiefs. The resemblance of name, situation, and manners seems to identify them with the Kardukians of the Greeks, and they still defend against the Ottoman Porte the antique freedom which they asserted against the successors of Cyrus. Poverty and ambition prompted them to embrace the profession of mercenary soldiers. The service of his father and uncle prepared the reign of the great Saladin, and the son of Job, or Ayyub, a simple Kurd, magnanimously smiled at his pedigree, which flattery deduced from the Arabian caliphs. So unconscious was Nur ad-Din of the impending ruin of his house that he constrained the reluctant youth to follow his uncle, Shirakuch, into Egypt. His military character was established by the defense of Alexandria, and if we may believe the Latins, he solicited and obtained from the Christian general the profane honors of knighthood. On the death of Shirakuch, the office of Grand Vizier was bestowed on Saladin as the youngest and least powerful of the emirs. But with the advice of his father, whom he invited to Cairo, his genius obtained the ascendant over his equals and attached the army to his person and interest. While Nur ed-Din lived, these ambitious Kurds were the most humble of his slaves, and the indiscreet murmurs of the divan were silenced by the prudent Ayyub, who loudly protested that at the command of the Sultan he himself would lead his sons in chains to the foot of the throne. Such language, he added in private, was prudent and proper in an assembly of your rivals, but we are now above fear and obedience, and the threats of Nur ed-Din shall not extort the tribute of a sugar-cane. His seasonable death relieved them from the odious and doubtful conflict. His son, a minor of 11 years of age, was left for a while to the emirs of Damascus, and the new lord of Egypt was decorated by the caliph with a very title that could sanctify his usurpation in the eyes of the people. Nor was Saladin long content with the possession of Egypt. He despoiled the Christians of Jerusalem and the Atabeks of Damascus, Aleppo, and Diyarbakir. Mecca and Medina acknowledged him for their temporal protector. His brother subdued the distant regions of Yemen or the Happy Arabia, and at the hour of his death his empire was spread from the African Tripoli to the Tigris and from the Indian Ocean to the mountains of Armenia. In the judgment of his character, the reproaches of treason and ingratitude strike forcibly on our minds, impressed as they are with the principle and experience of law and loyalty. But his ambition may in some measure be excused by the revolutions of Asia, which had erased every notion of legitimate succession, by the recent example of the Atabeks themselves, by his reverence to the son of his benefactor, his humane and generous behavior to the collateral branches, by their incapacity and his merit, by the approbation of the caliph, the sole source of all legitimate power, and above all by the wishes and interest of the people whose happiness is the first object of government. In his virtues and in those of his patron, they admire the singular union of the hero and the saint, for both Nur ed-Din and Saladin are ranked among the Mohammedan saints, and the constant meditation of the holy war appears to have shed a serious and sober color over their lives and actions. The youth of the latter was addicted to wine and women, but his aspiring spirit soon renounced the temptations of pleasure for the graver follies of fame and dominion. The garment of Saladin was, of course, woolen. Water was his only drink, and while he emulated the temperance, he surpassed the chastity of his Arabian prophet. Both in faith and practice he was a rigid Muslim. He ever deplored that the defense of religion had not allowed him to accomplish the pilgrimage of Mecca. But at the stated hours, 5 times each day, the Sultan devoutly prayed with his brethren. The involuntary omission of fasting was scrupulously repaid, and his perusal of the Quran on horseback between the approaching armies may be quoted as a proof, however ostentatious, of piety and courage. The superstitious doctrine of the sect of Shafi'i was the only study that he deigned to encourage. The poets were safe in his contempt, but all profane science was the object of his aversion, and a philosopher who had invented some speculative novelties was seized and strangled by the command of the royal saint. The justice of his divan was accessible to the meanest suppliant against himself and his ministers, and it was only for a kingdom that Saladin would deviate from the rule of equity. While the descendants of Seljuk and Zengi held his stirrup and smoothed his garments, he was affable and patient with the meanest of his servants. So boundless was his liberality that he distributed 12,000 horses at the siege of Acre, and at the time of his death no more than 47 drums of silver and 1 piece of gold coin were found in the treasury. Yet in a martial reign the tributes were diminished, and the wealthy citizens enjoyed without fear or danger the fruits of their industry. Egypt, Syria, and Arabia were adorned by the royal foundations of hospitals, colleges, and mosques, and Cairo was fortified with a wall and citadel, but his works were consecrated to public use. Nor did the Sultan indulge himself in a garden or palace of private luxury. In a fanatic age, himself a fanatic, the genuine virtues of Saladin commanded the esteem of the Christians. The Emperor of Germany gloried in his friendship. The Greek Emperor solicited his alliance, and the conquest of Jerusalem diffused and perhaps magnified his fame both in the East and West. During his short existence, the kingdom of Jerusalem was supported by the discord of the Turks and Saracens, and both the Fatimite caliphs and the sultans of Damascus were tempted to sacrifice the cause of their religion to the meaner considerations of private and present advantage. But the powers of Egypt, Syria, and Arabia were now united by a hero whom nature and fortune had armed against the Christians. All without now bore the most threatening aspect, and all was feeble and hollow in the internal state of Jerusalem. After the two first Baldwins, the brother and cousin of Godfrey of Bouillon, the scepter devolved by female succession to Melisenda, daughter of the second Baldwin, and her husband Fulk, Count of Anjou, the father by a former marriage of our English Plantagenets. Their two sons, Baldwin III and Amaury, waged a strenuous and not unsuccessful war against the infidels. But the son of Amaury, Baldwin IV, was deprived by the leprosy, a gift of the Crusades, of the faculties both of mind and body. His sister, Sibylla, the mother of Baldwin V, was his natural heiress. After the suspicious death of her child, she crowned her second husband, Guy of Lusignan, a prince of a handsome person, but of such base renown, that his own brother Geoffrey was heard to exclaim, "Since they have made him a king, surely they would have made me a god." The choice was generally blamed, and the most powerful vassal, Raymond, Count of Tripoli, who had been excluded from the succession and regency, entertained an implacable hatred against the king, and exposed his honour and conscience to the temptations of the sultan. Such were the guardians of the holy city, a leper, a child, a woman, a coward, and a traitor. Yet its fate was delayed 12 years by some supplies from Europe, by the valour of the military orders, and by the distant or domestic evocations of their great enemy. At length, on every side, the sinking state was encircled and pressed by hostile line, and the truce was violated by the Franks, whose existence it protected. A soldier of fortune, Reginald of Châtillon, had seized a fortress on the edge of the desert from whence he pillaged the caravans, insulted Mohammed, and threatened the cities of Mecca and Medina. Saladin condescended to complain, rejoiced in the denial of justice, and at the head of 80,000 horse and foot invaded the Holy Land. The choice of Tiberias for his first siege was suggested by the Count of Tripoli, to whom it belonged, and the King of Jerusalem was persuaded to drain his garrison and to arm his people for the relief of that important place. By the advice of the perfidious Raymond, the Christians were betrayed into a camp destitute of water. He fled on the first onset with the curses of both nations. Lusignan was overthrown with the loss of 30,000 men, and the wood of the True Cross, a dire misfortune, was left in the power of the infidels. The royal captive was conducted to the tent of Saladin, and as he fainted with thirst and terror, the generous victor presented him with a cup of sherbet, cooled in snow, without suffering his companion, Reginald of Châtillon, to partake of this pledge of hospitality and pardon. "The person and dignity of a king," said the sultan, "are sacred. But this impious robber must instantly acknowledge the prophet whom he has blasphemed, or meet the death which he has so often deserved." On the proud or conscientious refusal of the Christian warrior, Saladin struck him on the head with his scimitar, and Reginald was dispatched by the guards. The trembling Lusignan was sent to Damascus to an honorable prison and a speedy ransom, but the victory was stained by the execution of 230 knights of the hospital, the intrepid champions and martyrs of their faith. The kingdom was left without a head, and of the two grand masters of the military orders, the one was slain and the other was a prisoner. From all the cities, both of the seacoast and the inland country, the garrisons had been drawn away for this fatal field. Tyre and Tripoli alone could escape the rapid inroad of Saladin, and 3 months after the Battle of Tiberias, he appeared in arms before the gates of Jerusalem. He might expect that the siege of a city so venerable on earth and in heaven, so interesting to Europe and Asia, would rekindle the last sparks of enthusiasm, and that of 60,000 Christians every man would be a soldier and every soldier a candidate for martyrdom. But Queen Sibylla trembled for herself and her captive husband, and the barons and knights who had escaped from the sword and chains of the Turks displayed the same factious and selfish spirit in the public ruin. The most numerous portion of the inhabitants was composed of the Greek and Oriental Christians, whom experience had taught to prefer the Mohammedan before the Latin yoke, and the Holy Sepulchre attracted a base and needy crowd, without arms or courage, who subsisted only on the charity of the pilgrims. Some feeble and hasty efforts were made for the defense of Jerusalem, but in the space of 14 days a victorious army drove back the sallies of the besieged, planted their engines, opened the wall to the breadth of 15 cubits, applied their scaling ladders, and erected on the breach 12 banners of the Prophet and the Sultan. It was in vain that a barefoot procession of the queen, the women, and the monks implored the Son of God to save his tomb and his inheritance from impious violation. Their sole hope was in the mercy of the conqueror, and to their first suppliant deputation that mercy was sternly denied. He had sworn to avenge the patience and long-suffering of the Muslims. The hour of forgiveness was elapsed, and the moment was now arrived to expiate in blood the innocent blood which had been spilt by Godfrey and the First Crusaders. But a desperate and successful struggle of the Franks admonished the Sultan that his triumph was not yet secure. He listened with reverence to a solemn adjuration in the name of the common father of mankind, and a sentiment of human sympathy mollified the rigor of fanaticism and conquest. He consented to accept the city and to spare the inhabitants. The Greek and Oriental Christians were permitted to live under his dominion, but it was stipulated that in 40 days all the Franks and Latins should evacuate Jerusalem and be safely conducted to the seaports of Syria and Egypt, that 10 pieces of gold should be paid for each man, 5 for each woman, and 1 for every child, and that those who were unable to purchase their freedom should be detained in perpetual slavery. Of some writers it is a favorite and invidious theme to compare the humanity of Saladin with the massacre of the First Crusade. The difference would be merely personal, but we should not forget that the Christians had offered to capitulate, and that the Mohammedans of Jerusalem sustained the last extremities of an assault and storm. Justice is indeed due to the fidelity with which the Turkish conqueror fulfilled the conditions of the treaty, and he may be deservedly praised for the glance of pity which he cast on the misery of the vanquished. Instead of a rigorous exaction of his debt, he accepted a sum of 30,000 bezants for the ransom of 7,000 poor. 2,000 or 3,000 more were dismissed by his gratuitous clemency, and the number of slaves was reduced to 11,000 or 14,000 persons. In this interview with the queen, his words and even his tears suggested the kindest consolations. His liberal alms were distributed among those who had been made orphans or widows by the fortune of war, and while the knights of the hospital were in arms against him, he allowed their more pious brethren to continue, during the term of a year, the care and service of the sick. In these acts of mercy, the virtue of Saladin deserves our admiration and love. He was above the necessity of dissimulation, and his stern fanaticism would have prompted him to dissemble rather than to affect this profane compassion for the enemies of the Quran. After Jerusalem had been delivered from the presence of the strangers, the Sultan made his triumphal entry, his banners waving in the wind, and to the harmony of martial music. The great mosque of Omar, which had been converted into a church, was again consecrated to one God and his prophet, Muhammad. The walls and pavement were purified with rose water, and a pulpit, the labor of Nur ed-Din, was erected in the sanctuary. But when the golden cross that glittered on the dome was cast down and dragged through the streets, the Christians of every sect uttered a lamentable groan, which was answered by the joyful shouts of the Muslims. In four ivory chests, the patriarch had collected the crosses, the images, the vases, and the relics of the holy place. They were seized by the conqueror, who was desirous of presenting the caliph with the trophies of Christian idolatry. He was persuaded, however, to entrust them to the patriarch and prince of Antioch, and the pious pledge was redeemed by Richard of England at the expense of 52,000 byzants of gold. The nations might fear and hope the immediate and final expulsion of the Latins from Syria, which was yet delayed above a century after the death of Saladin. In the career of victory, he was first checked by the resistance of Tyre. The troops and garrisons which had capitulated were imprudently conducted to the same port. Their numbers were adequate to the defense of the place, and the arrival of Conrad of Montferrat inspired the disorderly crowd with confidence and union. His father, a venerable pilgrim, had been made prisoner in the Battle of Tiberias, but that disaster was unknown in Italy and Greece when the son was urged by ambition and piety to visit the inheritance of his royal nephew, the infant Baldwin. The view of the Turkish banners warned him from the hostile coast of Jaffa, and Conrad was unanimously hailed as the prince and champion of Tyre, which was already besieged by the conqueror of Jerusalem. The firmness of his zeal, and perhaps his knowledge of a generous foe, enabled him to brave the threats of the Sultan, and to declare that should his aged parent be exposed before the walls, he himself would discharge the first arrow and glory in his descent from a Christian martyr. The Egyptian fleet was allowed to enter the harbor of Tyre, but the chain was suddenly drawn, and five galleys were either sunk or taken. 1,000 Turks were slain in a sally, and Saladin, after burning his engines, concluded a glorious campaign by a disgraceful retreat to Damascus. He was soon assailed by a more formidable tempest. The pathetic narratives and even the pictures that represented in lively colors the servitude and profanation of Jerusalem awakened the torpid sensibility of Europe. The Emperor Frederick Barbarossa and the kings of France and England assumed the cross, and the tardy magnitude of their armaments was anticipated by the maritime states of the Mediterranean and the ocean. The skillful and provident Italians first embarked in the ships of Genoa, Pisa, and Venice. They were speedily followed by the most eager pilgrims of France, Normandy, and the Western Isles. The powerful succor of Flanders, Frisia, and Denmark filled near 100 vessels, and the northern warriors were distinguished in the field by lofty stature and a ponderous battle axe. Their increasing multitudes could no longer be confined within the walls of Tyre, or remain obedient to the voice of Conrad. They pitied the misfortunes and revered the dignity of Lusignan, who was released from prison, perhaps to divide the army of the Franks. He proposed the recovery of Ptolemais, or Acre, 30 miles to the south of Tyre, and the place was first invested by 2,000 horse and 30,000 foot under his nominal command. I shall not expatiate on the story of this memorable siege, which lasted near 2 years, and consumed in a narrow space the forces of Europe and Asia. Never did the flame of enthusiasm burn with fiercer and more destructive rage. Nor could the true believers, a common appellation, who consecrated their own martyrs, refuse some applause to the mistaken zeal and courage of their adversaries. At the sound of the holy trumpet, the Muslims of Egypt, Syria, Arabia, and the Oriental provinces assembled under the servant of the Prophet. His camp was pitched and removed within a few miles of Acre, and he labored night and day for the relief of his brethren and the annoyance of the Franks. 9 battles, not unworthy of the name, were fought in the neighborhood of Mount Carmel with such vicissitude of fortune that in one attack the Sultan forced his way into the city, that in one sally the Christians penetrated to the royal tent. By the means of divers and pigeons, a regular correspondence was maintained with the besieged, and as often as the sea was left open, the exhausted garrison was withdrawn and a fresh supply was poured into the place. The Latin camp was thinned by famine, the sword, and the climate, but the tents of the dead were replenished with new pilgrims who exaggerated the strength and speed of their approaching countrymen. The vulgar was astonished by the report that the Pope himself, with an innumerable crusade, was advanced as far as Constantinople. The march of the Emperor filled the East with more serious alarms. The obstacles which he encountered in Asia, and perhaps in Greece, were raised by the policy of Saladin. His joy on the death of Barbarossa was measured by his esteem, and the Christians were rather dismayed than encouraged at the sight of the Duke of Swabia and his way-worn remnant of 5,000 Germans. At length, in the spring of the second year, the royal fleets of France and England cast anchor in the Bay of Acre, and the siege was more vigorously prosecuted by the youthful emulation of the two kings, Philip Augustus and Richard Plantagenet. After every resource had been tried and every hope was exhausted, the defenders of Acre submitted to their fate. A capitulation was granted, but their lives and liberties were taxed at the hard conditions of a ransom of 200,000 pieces of gold, the deliverance of 100 nobles, and 1,500 inferior captives, and the restoration of the wood of the Holy Cross. Some doubts in the agreement and some delay in the execution rekindled the fury of the Franks, and 3,000 Muslims, almost in the Sultan's view, were beheaded by the command of the sanguinary Richard. By the conquest of Acre, the Latin powers acquired a strong town and a convenient harbor, but the advantage was most dearly purchased. The minister and historian of Saladin computes, from the report of the enemy, that their numbers at different periods amounted to 500,000 or 600,000, that more than 100,000 Christians were slain, that a far greater number was lost by disease or shipwreck, and that a small portion of this mighty host could return in safety to their native countries. Philip Augustus and Richard I are the only kings of France and England who have fought under the same banners. But the holy service in which they were enlisted was incessantly disturbed by their national jealousy, and the two factions which they protected in Palestine were more averse to each other than to the common enemy. In the eyes of the Orientals, the French monarch was superior in dignity and power, and in the emperor's absence, the Latins revered him as their temporal chief. His exploits were not adequate to his fame. Philip was brave, but the statesman predominated in his character. He was soon weary of sacrificing his health and interest on a barren coast. The surrender of Acre became the signal of his departure. Nor could he justify this unpopular desertion by leaving the Duke of Burgundy with 500 knights and 10,000 foot for the service of the Holy Land. The King of England, though inferior in dignity, surpassed his rival in wealth and military renown, and if heroism be confined to brutal and ferocious valor, Richard Plantagenet will stand high among the heroes of the age. The memory of Coeur de Lion, of the lion-hearted prince, was long dear and glorious to his English subjects, and at the distance of 60 years it was celebrated in proverbial sayings by the grandsons of the Turks and Saracens, against whom he had fought. His tremendous name was employed by the Syrian mothers to silence their infants, and if a horse suddenly started from the way, his rider was wont to exclaim, "Dost thou think King Richard is in that bush?" His cruelty to the Mohammedans was the effect of temper and zeal. But I cannot believe that a soldier, so free and fearless in the use of his lance, would have descended to whet a dagger against his valiant brother Conrad of Montferrat, who was slain at Tyre by some secret assassins. After the surrender of Acre and the departure of Philip, the King of England led the Crusaders to the recovery of the seacoast, and the cities of Caesarea and Jaffa were added to the fragments of the kingdom of Lusignan. A march of 100 miles from Acre to Ascalon was a great and perpetual battle of 11 days. In the disorder of his troops, Saladin remained on the field with 17 guards, without lowering his standard or suspending the sound of his brazen kettle drum. He again rallied and renewed the charge, and his preachers or heralds called aloud on the Unitarians manfully to stand up against the Christian idolaters. But the progress of these idolaters was irresistible, and it was only by demolishing the walls and buildings of Ascalon that the Sultan could prevent them from occupying an important fortress on the confines of Egypt. During a severe winter, the armies slept, but in the spring, the Franks advanced within a day's march of Jerusalem under the leading standard of the English king, and his active spirit intercepted a convoy, or caravan, of 7,000 camels. Saladin had fixed his station in the holy city, but the city was struck with consternation and discord. He fasted, he prayed, he preached, he offered to share the dangers of the siege. But his Mamelukes, who remembered the fate of their companions at Acre, pressed the Sultan with loyal or seditious clamours to reserve his person and their courage for the future defence of the religion and empire. The Muslims were delivered by the sudden, or, as they deemed, the miraculous retreat of the Christians, and the laurels of Richard were blasted by the prudence or envy of his companions. The hero, ascending a hill and veiling his face, exclaimed with an indignant voice, "Those who are unwilling to rescue are unworthy to view the sepulchre of Christ." After his return to Acre on the news that Jaffa was surprised by the Sultan, he sailed with some merchant vessels and leaped foremost on the beach. The castle was relieved by his presence, and 60,000 Turks and Saracens fled before his arms. The discovery of his weakness provoked them to return in the morning, and they found him carelessly encamped before the gates with only 17 knights and 300 archers. Without counting their numbers, he sustained their charge, and we learn from the evidence of his enemies that the King of England, grasping his lance, rode furiously along their front, from the right to the left wing, without meeting an adversary who dared to encounter his career. Am I writing the history of Orlando or Amadis? During these hostilities, a languid and tedious negotiation between the Franks and Muslims was started and continued and broken and again resumed and again broken. Some acts of royal courtesy, the gift of snow and fruit, the exchange of Norway hawks and Arabian horses, softened the asperity of religious war. From the vicissitude of success, the monarchs might learn to suspect that heaven was neutral in the quarrel. Nor, after the trial of each other, could either hope for a decisive victory. The health both of Richard and Saladin appeared to be in a declining state, and they respectively suffered the evils of distant and domestic warfare. Plantagenet was impatient to punish a perfidious rival who had invaded Normandy in his absence, and the indefatigable Sultan was subdued by the cries of the people, who was the victim, and of the soldiers, who were the instruments of his martial zeal. The first demands of the King of England were the restitution of Jerusalem, Palestine, and the True Cross. and he firmly declared that himself and his brother pilgrims would end their lives in the pious labour rather than return to Europe with ignominy and remorse. But the conscience of Saladin refused, without some weighty compensation, to restore the idols or promote the idolatry of the Christians. He asserted with equal firmness his religious and civil claim to the sovereignty of Palestine, discounted on the importance and sanctity of Jerusalem, and rejected all terms of the establishment or partition of the Latins. The marriage which Richard proposed of his sister with the Sultan's brother was defeated by the difference of faith. The princess abhorred the embraces of a Turk, and Adel, or Safadin, would not easily renounce a plurality of wives. A personal interview was declined by Saladin, who alleged their mutual ignorance of each other's language, and the negotiation was managed with much art and delay by their interpreters and envoys. The final agreement was equally disapproved by the zealots of both parties, by the Roman pontiff and the caliph of Baghdad. It was stipulated that Jerusalem and the Holy Sepulchre should be open, without tribute or vexation, to the pilgrimage of the Latin Christians, that after the demolition of Ascalon, they should inclusively possess the seacoast from Jaffa to Tyre, that the Count of Tripoli and the Prince of Antioch should be comprised in the truce, and that during 3 years and 3 months all hostilities should cease. The principal chiefs of the two armies swore to the observance of the treaty, but the monarchs were satisfied with giving their word and their right hand, and the royal majesty was excused from an oath which always implies some suspicion of falsehood and dishonour. Richard embarked for Europe to seek a long captivity and a premature grave, and the space of a few months concluded the life and glories of Saladin. The Orientals describe his edifying death, which happened at Damascus, but they seem ignorant of the equal distribution of his alms among the three religions, or of the display of a shroud instead of a standard to admonish the East of the instability of human greatness. The unity of empire was dissolved by his death. His sons were oppressed by the stronger arm of their uncle Safadin. The hostile interests of the sultans of Egypt, Damascus, and Aleppo were again revived, and the Franks or Latins stood and breathed and hoped in their fortresses along the Syrian coast. The noblest monument of a conqueror's fame and of the terror which he inspired is the Saladin Tenth, a general tax which was imposed on the laity and even the clergy of the Latin Church for the service of the Holy War. The practice was too lucrative to expire with the occasion, and this tribute became the foundation of all the tithes and tenths on ecclesiastical benefices which have been granted by the Roman pontiffs to Catholic sovereigns, or reserved for the immediate use of the Apostolic See. This pecuniary emolument must have tended to increase the interest of the popes in the recovery of Palestine. After the death of Saladin, they preached the crusade by their epistles, their legates, and their missionaries, and the accomplishment of the pious work might have been expected from the zeal and talents of Innocent III. Under that young and ambitious priest, the successors of St. Peter attained the full meridian of their greatness, and in a reign of 18 years, he exercised a despotic command over the emperors and kings whom he raised and deposed, over the nations whom an interdict of months or years deprived, for the offence of their rulers, of the exercise of Christian worship. In the Council of the Lateran he acted as the ecclesiastical, almost as the temporal sovereign of the East and West. It was at the feet of his legate that John of England surrendered his crown, and Innocent may boast of the two most signal triumphs over sense and humanity, the establishment of transubstantiation and the origin of the Inquisition. At his voice, two crusades, the fourth and the fifth, were undertaken. But except a king of Hungary, the princes of the Second Order were at the head of the pilgrims. The forces were inadequate to the design, nor did the effects